I am the Duchess of Wessex, and my dear, what's yours?
A Baroness of Pignerol.
Duchess, it is a nice occasion to run into such a fine lady in such an inn. And I was wondering, I've heard that you had the privilege yourself of meeting the very famous Baron of Munchausen. Would you be kind enough to tell us of the circumstances of that encounter? Welcome among
the Rollists.
No, not you. Okay, so a very special episode with a game designer in person, not via Skype like Monty Cook, who would not fly to London to be with me. A slightly inebriated interview also, as we are at the end of our game of Baron of Munchausen, which is not technically a drinking game, but which encourages the consumption of a number of delicious things, including white wine, filthy, low-standard Belgian beers, and Armagnac. So, James Wallace, my first traditional question is to ask, I think I'm going to win any award with this episode. I'm totally submitting it next year. What would be your explanation, description to no one who never heard of it, of what is a tabletop role-playing game? And meantime, I will check on my strudel.
It is a question that people have been trying to answer since the 1970s. How do you explain tabletop role play in a handful of words in a really concise way? And I don't think anyone has ever come up with a really good, quick description. I tend to say it's a bit like being an actor in a play where there's a director who knows the story and a bunch of actors, each of whom know their parts, but who don't know the story, but whose job it is to work it out and to kind of narrate their way through the story with the games master giving them guidance and playing all the minor parts and saying whether things happen or whether they don't. That's my standard quick description of what role play is.
Cool. You seem well versed in answering that question. What was your very first experience with tabletop role playing games?
It was Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. Well, it was sort of Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. AD&D was the first one I played a lot. I did actually try Traveller very briefly first. I was at boarding school in the early 1980s, and there wasn't that much else to do, and I hated it. And there was a guy in my house who loved Traveller. Even at the age of 15, he was having articles published in White Dwarf for Traveller. Traveller was his great love. So I played Traveller, and I didn't take to it. But there was a guy in a different house who was an AD&D nut, and he got me involved in his AD&D campaign. And I played AD&D pretty obsessively for about a year and a half. Started my first fanzine still at school, aged 15, and then had my first professional article published when I was 17. I discovered that writing stuff for publication was almost as fun as role play.
Just going back to when you were talking about what you know about kind of tabletop and how to explain it to someone else. Surely it's not just the Dungeon Master or the Game Master challenging the players, but it's also the players challenging the Dungeon Master and the Game Master.
I mean, absolutely. It's cooperative storytelling. It's people working together to tell a story. We've used the term role-playing game for 40 years now, more than 40 years. And yet I'm not sure that it is a traditional game in the sense that most people think about it. Obviously, there's no winners and losers, but also for a lot of games, there's no set finish point as well. You just keep going. You keep playing week after week. And there are very few role-playing campaigns that actually finish, that you actually say, okay, we're done now. Most of them kind of peter off because people go off and get married and get jobs in other countries or have kids or something like that. And you have a couple of sessions and it switches, you know, you go monthly and it's every 6 months and then you might have a final session. But it becomes, I think, particularly when you've got a good group dynamic, everyone feeds into the story, everyone brings ideas to it, whether it's through the portrayal of their characters or in the better groups where the GM lets players invent part of the background. One of the best role-playing experiences I ever had was one of the first times I ever played Emperor of the Petal Throne with a fellow called Paul Mason, who was a well-known fanzine editor back in the mid-late 80s, early 90s. There must have been about 10 of us playing, and it was this big group dynamic in this weird alien culture. And Paul and his girlfriend went off to the kitchen and made lunch, and the game just continued entirely without them. And they came back about half an hour later and said, "What's been going on?" And we told them where we were now. You know, complete trust, and it didn't derail the game at all. And it was up to that point, I'd be going, "No, the GM is in control. The GM must be in control of the story. The GM must know what's going on, or the story will topple over and the whole thing will collapse and blow up." Like Atlantis. That moment was a kind of blinding light in my, you know, one of the moments where you understand that the games you've been playing are actually so much bigger than the way you've been playing them. So yeah, it's really collaborative storytelling. But when you tell people, yes, come round for an evening of collaborative storytelling, they're not going to come round. Most of them anyway. You say, come round and play a game, they'll come round and play a game.
The Baron is a delightful man. He does love a good drink. But, well, you see, what happens behind closed doors. Tries to stay behind closed doors, but once I've had a little bit to drink, who knows what might come out. But you see, yes, oh, this Baron, he is a despicable man. Not only did he try to get on with the maid, oh gosh, I don't know if I could go on.
No, go on.
He likes to... I don't know.
Oh, come on. Just because he likes to disguise and pretend it's not him to do all the deeds he can do in the world. You don't have to be shy to tell that.
Well, I just don't want to fully ruin his reputation, you see, but he does like to dress as a woman sometimes and goes around and pretends to be his wife. It's a bit awkward, you see, especially when, you know, he tries to get it on with some stable boys. But let's not get into that.
But, Duchess, Countess.
Duchess, please.
Duchess, glorious lady. I thought it's well known that the Baron's wife is dead. That tragic hot air balloon accident.
Oh, no.
17-.
That was a cover-up. Because, you see, she was actually going to get some surgery done. But it was all, you know, covered over quite extensively.
But, Duchess, it is very, very commonly known that the Baron wouldn't let himself or any of his relatives close to any kind of doctor. This is extremely well documented.
Yes, it isn't actually a doctor as such, but she desperately needed some...
I heard about this, Duchess. It was a mistranslation from the French. It's a duck, isn't it?
Why, yes, it is, actually. It was a duck. And, I don't know, he was described as a strange being that came to see his wife. I don't really know the full details of it, but it was a bit odd from what I heard. But yes, this Baron is a weird individual behind the scenes. But, you know, we must always be ready for the people and show them what they want to know. Obviously.
You mentioned you've been in a boarding school. Where because the show is also about where role players come from, because they actually can come from very different walk of life. Where are you from? What was your childhood like, etc.?
Oh, it's a good question. I'm originally from Suffolk, and people who've listened to the Baron Mitchell will be going, "Oh, he was at Framlingham, like Ed Sheeran. He was at Framlingham College." No, I wasn't. I was at Eton, actually. I'm an exact contemporary of David Cameron's. We did A-level economics
Yay.
Together.
We love him.
No, in fact, I can't... I try not to... I'd had a bloody awful time at school. I really didn't enjoy it at all. Which, of course, is English understatement, for I very nearly died. But I think we played D&D together once. I genuinely do.
No way! No way! You're telling me David Cameron, former prime minister and architect of the referendum with its brilliant result. I mean, it's different when you know people on a personal level. Are you telling me he played Dungeons and Dragons?
I think we did. I mean, I don't have a clear memory, but I'm pretty sure we did. The thing is, my DM at school was a fellow called Josh Astor, who is, I believe, Sarah Cameron's half-brother. I know. Josh Astor had an interesting time. He was expelled from school on drugs charges after I'd stopped role-playing with him. Disappeared for a bit, dated Jay Jagger for a while, did 5 years for dealing coke. And then the last I heard of him for a long time was one of those little one paragraph news stories on the inside front cover of a newspaper, which had the headline, "Naked Man on Hotel Roof, High on Crack." Which was, you know, when that's your former DM, that's a moment to treasure. And then he resurfaced as part of David Cameron's kind of inner circle. He's one of David Cameron's mates. So, but I'm pretty sure I took over his dwarf character, who was called Thoran. I'm not making any of this up. This is true.
I don't have any coins.
Keep talking.
I mean, it's interesting because Ethan has this enormous reputation, but it was a hotbed of role play. There was, I mentioned this mate of mine, Angus, who's now writes science fiction stories and does other stuff. But he was getting published in White Dwarf aged 14 or 15. There were three guys, David Honigman, Phil Parker, and John Butterfield, I believe. And they wrote a book called What is Dungeons and Dragons, which was published by Puffin while they were still at school. There was another guy, Alex Scott, who I'm still in touch with, who wrote an RPG system for Puffin called Maelstrom, set in Tudor England, which was also published while he was still at school. And I was, meanwhile, editing fanzines and getting published in Warlock magazine. We didn't go on to dominate the British role-playing industry, but there was a little while there where, although nobody knew it, a large chunk of British role-playing culture was coming out of Eton College, 1984 to 85.
Gary, do you have a question? Oh,
I don't actually talk about this. I'm talking about this because I'm pissed. I don't normally talk about this stuff. Because the other thing is, the moment you say, "I was at Eton," people get all these preconceptions about you. I think, oh, you must be a toff. You must be enormously rich. I'm a part-time college lecturer and game designer.
Well, it's eponymous with my favorite dessert, so I don't mind.
Oh, yes.
Eton mess for people across the pond or beyond who don't know what's...
You're supposed to crush the strawberries. That's the act. Proper Eton mess has crushed strawberries, not sliced strawberries.
Of course, yeah. What was your first role-playing game creation then?
I was doing this fanzine when I was 15 or so. I'd seen fanzines and I just thought that looks interesting. And I had a typewriter and 20 quid burning a hole in my pocket. I was like, I could start a fanzine. And I did. I printed 50 copies of a thing called We're Man, which stood for Windsor and Eton Role Playing Enthusiasts Magazine and Newsletter, because I was that kind of geek. And there was a shop in Windsor called Treasure Trap. Castle Keeps. Treasure Trap was live role play. Castle Keeps, and they had a role playing section. They were a souvenir shop mostly, but they had a role playing section downstairs, and they agreed to stock it for me. And that was, you know, that was the moment the publishing bug bit me. But that was kind of, We're Man didn't really do anything. It was awful. It was genuinely very bad, or at least my stuff was very bad. We had a couple of fantastic artists who did stuff for us. And a fellow called Spike Jones, that was my second fanzine. Ignore me, I'm just burbling. But yeah, so we did that for about 8 issues, which is one of the reasons I did very badly in my A-levels, because I was publishing, I had an issue of the fanzine to get out, damn it. Who needs to revise for economics? Which is why I'm a part-time university lecturer and David Cameron is Prime Minister, or was Prime Minister.
Please tell us of that interesting story where you were locked in the basement with the Dame of Northumbria.
Oh, that was such an unfortunate event. I was throwing a very lush party in my residence in the Italian Alps. And of course, that poor soul of my butler forgot to...
I heard that you didn't have anybody arrive, actually. I heard that you put on a party and nobody came.
That's absolutely not true. That's because you were there and you were already so drunk you were sleeping on the couch, snoring and making a terrible noise.
Was I?
Yes, you were.
Oh. I'm sorry, but
Before you interrupt a contest like that, I think a gentleman should introduce himself. I have no plan of interrupting you until further notice, and I will introduce myself, and I hope, mister, you will do so as well. I am Alphonse von Walden, fine officer of the Guarda Bellona of the King of Spain.
Very good. Well, I am the Earl, rather plump, Pimble Louis Smythe, from the southern uplands, somewhere there, yes.
I was saying, yeah, that poor man of my butler forgot to bring out the good champagne, and I had to go and fetch it myself. At the same time, this damn... I forgot her name already. She's such a nobody.
His name was Brian.
His name? Oh, he was dressed up as well then. Oh my God, how rude of him. Anyway, I was fetching the good champagne for
my... I think you'll find that dressing up is fashion. I was over in Paris. Simply everybody was dressed up as other sexes, some other species, and a couple of people as vegetables. It was quite extraordinary. I didn't go for it myself. I'm not dressed as a potato. That's just the way I was born.
Oh, okay, sorry, I must have got confused, because you see, in my lands, it's only during Carnival that you really dress up and you overdo your appearances. Then, of course, you have those who pretend not to be dressed up, but they are, but that's a whole other story, which I won't get into it now, because otherwise it will take too much of your precious time.
No, no, please do. Please tell us more.
I think it is an important topic to dwell upon, too, because that is the pride of my region, Bologna. One of our researchers brought this tradition of dressing up like the opposite sex from his travel to Venus.
Oh, yeah, I think I heard about that. Is this kind of... It's something really strange. We don't really abide to that. We are quite open in what we want to do, and we dress up during Carnival. And it's really not fun to be dressed up and pretend not to be dressed up. Where's the fun of it? I'm sorry, I don't get that story.
Well, first of all, I would let you trash the name of the Baron von Frimuth, who travelled on his balloon all the way to Venice and Mars and brought us those fine traditions. I happen to be a man who likes a lot to dress up as a woman, which is great. And it is a long tradition in my region of Bologna, where we have numbers of pine lumberjacks who have such taste as well.
Oh, I remember now. That's when your cousin, or it was your third uncle in line from your mother's side, got lost in his travels, and instead of going to Vienna, ended up in Venice during Carnival. And he realized that life could be fun, and you took over that tradition. It's not Mars, it's not Venus. You've been fooled by that one. It was the Venice Carnival, and he just made the story his own one.
I was just going to say, I was talking to Venus last night, and she denies the whole thing absolutely.
See? People backed me up on this, because it's the truth.
We've lost track. More story, please. More story.
Of course, I was just going back to my fine champagne and the poor soul of the butler who forgot to take it out from the cellar, so I went to dig it out myself.
Champagne, my dear. Surely it was vodka.
That would come later. Champagne was just the starter. It makes you lightheaded, and then you can get into some more serious stuff, which would normally be vodka. I would go for gin myself, but some very Russian-oriented people insist in drinking vodka, and I have to make them happy because I'm a fantastic hostess, and that's what I do in my life.
I'm sorry, but what's this got to do with the basement, where this all started from?
That's what I was trying to get to before I keep on getting interrupted.
Please be quick, so I'm getting a bit bored of this vodka.
I totally agree with you. So, I was fetching the champagne, and, oh yeah, it was the mister dressed up as a woman, pretending not to be dressed up, who followed me, thinking I was going out to the garden, and he got locked up when I went to walk out of the cellar with my wine. He just startled me, and I accidentally locked the door in front of myself. And then it took me a whole half an hour to unjam the lock with that drunken, dressed-up thing that couldn't shut up. It was so drunk, it couldn't shut up.
Half an hour? My dear, I heard it was 3 days.
Nah. That was actually the mister dressed as a miss.
who would have... Okay, that was the mister dressed as a miss. When I went out, I locked the door behind to keep him, her, it there. And it took him 3 days, and then I forgot about him. And that's how it took him 3 days to get out.
But I thought you got locked in there with him.
Oh, absolutely no. No, 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 no. That's just terrible rumours. All my guests can confirm that I was at the party all night, save for those 30 minutes.
I don't remember.
Of course you were snoring on the sofa. Even the orchestra could not overcome your snoring. That was quite embarrassing, I must admit.
What orchestra?
Never mind. Never mind. But yeah, that's how it went to happen. And it's just a made-up story. It's just a hot balloon story again. It just grows, grows, grows until it explodes. But I went out. I was away for 30 minutes.
The same thing happened to the chap in the dress. I heard he just grew and grew until he exploded.
Probably, yeah. That's why it took my servants 3 days to fetch him from the cellar. And then the mess. We had to clean everything. And when it exploded, he even had the guts to break some of the finest bottles of wine I had preserved for special occasions. He still has to pay me back for those. How rude of him.
So that was scenarios and articles and, you know, the inevitable, here's a critical hit system for D&D, which everybody wrote one, and reviews and stuff. As soon as I got to university, I came down to London, I went to Middlesex, I started another fanzine called Sound of Fury, which had a proper editorial budget and proper layout. I'd learnt a lot in the intervening years. And that, again, we didn't create role-playing systems within it, but it attracted a whole bunch of contributors, including people from America. There's a fellow called Spike Jones, who is still a freelance role-playing writer. I was publishing his first work in about 1985, 1986. Then I went, and I was getting published in White Dwarf, and I was getting published in Adventure magazine and a bunch of the crop of role-playing magazines that had sprung up in the late 80s. And then I went over to Gen Con, 1989, having left college. I'd made friends with Eric Wujek, who is dead now, but his reputation has kind of died with him. The two things he's remembered for is the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles role-playing game, which was one of the first things to license the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles brand before the TV series.
It was still the dark and gritty comics.
It was, and then it took off as a kid series, and obviously it made Eric and Palladium Books very rich. It did amazingly well. And then in the early 90s, he created Amber Dices Roleplay, which was the first Dices role-playing system to be commercially published, and is still a blisteringly good piece of design. It's brilliantly written and genuinely captured. It's one of the great role-playing systems for capturing the spirit of the books it's based on. I think that and Ghostbusters are the two great... Oh, and Greg Kostikian's first edition Star Wars, the great licensed RPGs. Nothing else comes close. But anyway, so Eric had been reading my fanzine. He'd been sending for copies across the Atlantic. So I crashed with him in Detroit. We talked about game design, and then we went to Gen Con. He introduced me to Kevin Sambida at Palladium, who said, oh, we're going to write a book set in England, and the writer's just dropped off due to other commitments. Do you want it? And that was my start as an actual role-playing, professional role-playing designer as such. The book was Mutants in Avalon for the After the Bomb series for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. It's set in the future. There's been a disaster. All the animals have mutated into humanoids. The humans are the bad guys. King Arthur's back. It is as good as it sounds. There's some interesting stuff in there. It was fun to write. I did another book for them and then headed off and did other stuff.
Among those other stuff you mentioned, was that Once Upon a Time?
Once Upon a Time was created by myself, Andrew Rilston, and Richard Lambert, who I'd known, the other fanzine creators. We met up for a New Year's party in 1990 in Glasgow, I think. Richard wasn't there. Andrew brought along a very rough prototype, back of business cards thing that he and Richard have been messing around with. And I looked at it and I went, this is brilliant and it's got commercial potential, but it needs a lot of work. So we play tested it for about 2 years, refining it all the way. Then I took it over to Gen Con and touted it around Gen Con. No, it must have been a year and a half. Gen Con 91, because Vampire was out. Vampire had just come out and was the big buzz. And I couldn't get any publishers to bite. And I was sitting around with Spike Jones, who I mentioned, and he introduced me to a friend of his called Nicole Lindroos. And she said, oh, I've just left White Wolf, where I laid out Vampire the Masquerade. And I'm either going to go and work for GDW and Mark Miller, who do Traveller, or I'm going to go work for John Nephew at Atlas Games. What's this card game I've heard about? And I showed her the card game. She phoned John Nephew. I took a Greyhound bus over to Minnesota, showed it to John Nephew, and we signed a handwritten contract for it then and there. Then it went through another year and a half of playtesting and finally came out at, I can never remember if it was Gen Con 93 or 94. It was the one that Magic launched at. So us and our little card game, nobody gave a fuck. Really, genuinely. The sheer people just blazing, you know, walking past the Atlas booth to get to the Wizards booth, where people were literally crowding five or six deep round the booth to get any Magic cards. It was already clear at that point they had got something completely huge on their hands. And that was first edition Once Upon a Time came out. It didn't do terribly well, but John had enough faith in it to do the second edition, and that was the one that took off. And it's done about 250,000 copies now in,
wow,
I think, 10 languages. I can never remember how many languages. It's kind of embarrassing. I will say there's a pirated Chinese edition. You know, the Chinese pirate board games, there is a pirated Chinese edition. When someone pirates your card game, you know you've arrived.
Of course, sir. I know you are very well travelled and you know a lot of the world. So please do tell us of the time you were on the Orient Express and you forgot to get off at your stop. And you ended up in Mongolia.
Oh, yes, splendid. I should introduce myself. Baron Wallace of Framlingham, third of that ilk. It's, well, as you know, it is a time of scientific advancement and invention. Fellow Stevenson, Watt invented the steam thing to power, produce things through factories, mostly by, I think, making lots of tea. But, yes, steam power. So, the Orient Express, the steam engine, sadly, it being the 17-, is still in a fairly early stage of its infancy. So, deciding that I wanted to go to the Orient, I decided that I should invent a way of going there. Went to talk to the Stevenson chap, and he said, yes, you'll need to build a railway, you'll need to put down track, you'll need to that sounds like an awful lot of work.
But surely, didn't you have to get planning permission first?
I'm a nobleman, dear lady, but there's such things for the common people, the plebs, the councils, the likes of that. One just rides roughshod over the country and apologises afterwards. So, yes, and indeed for that matter the sea as well. We struck east from East Anglia, heading further east into France. Well, frankly, I lose track. Geography is for proles. But we headed generally east, sort of in the general direction of, east, really. And we had a system.
Towards Kathmandu. How did that happen?
Kathmandu is, I believe, indeed in the east. No, we were heading towards the Orient, which I think Kathmandu is in the Orient. I've no idea, really.
Well, I don't know. I was asking you how that managed.
I had a Welshman on the front of the locomotive who said he'd read an atlas once. Now, it was his job to lay the track as we were going, so we weren't progressing terribly fast. He'd put down a couple of these things, and then I had a Scotsman at the back who'd pick them up again and pass them forward over the locomotive so the Welshman could put them down again.
Okay, so that's basically how the train got lost and ended up in a pub in Kent, isn't it?
It is. Well, yes. Precisely. Having crossed the channel, I believe the Welshman developed a thirst. So he doubled back. I was having a sleep at the time, having had a very good breakfast. And the next thing I woke up, we were in Gravesend. I didn't know it was Gravesend. People were speaking in appalling accents and wearing outlandish clothes. But after a couple of days in a tavern, we ascertained that we were not in either Kathmandu or Nepal or... Where was it we ended up? Mongolia. Or the east. It was the east of Kent. East Kent, which I don't recommend. So we set off again.
Certainly a fine gentleman like you wouldn't confuse Kent for Mongolia, would you?
It's a very easy mistake to make, really. They've got a couple of hills there, and really, I know I've travelled an awful lot, but I tend to do it while wearing blinkers, because the sight of unfamiliar things scares me. So I engage servants to find out where we are.
Let's not be around the bush here. You are, in fact, blind, aren't you?
Yes. Yes, I am, but I'm...
I'm sorry to out you here now, but I had to kind of...
It's quite true. I've been trying to hide it for years. My sense of smell is extraordinary. But was so blinded, if you'll pardon the phrase, by the stench of the Kentish people that I just assumed we were somewhere outlandish and foreign.
So anyway, we set off again. Unfortunately, the Welshman had over-imbibed in the tavern where we'd been residing in Gravesend and was frankly all over the place. I think we went via, it was east to Kathmandu via South Africa. It took a while. I think it took 3.5 years. As I say, I was asleep for most of it.
I thought it took 6.
Oh, quite possibly, as I say. It was not so much sleep, but hibernation. My mother was a hamster.
You said you were in Kent. Or would you cross from Kent to the continent? That is nonsense. There's no way a train could accomplish to have feet.
We were using very long rails and a very floaty train. So, especially when I invented, you know, nobody invented the Orient Express. I invented it. I said we should invent the Orient Express and we should make it floaty. So, as I understood it.
I heard you actually used dolphins to swim the rails across.
Well, I mean, to be honest, I can't be entirely sure because being blind, I couldn't tell. But there were all kinds of strange squawking noises. I assumed it was the people of Kent. But it may well have been dolphins. So yeah, so we were Kent and then France. I could tell it was France from the smell of wine and garlic and peasants. And then South Africa and what I thought was going to be Kathmandu, but turned out to be Mongolia. Yeah, it, charming place, Mongolia. Very difficult to get a pint. But or at least they served me a pint, but I'm not quite sure what it was a pint of. I think it may have been fermented yak's milk. Yes, we left the train there. Yes.
What's this I hear about you getting arrested as soon as you entered Mongolia?
Ah, well, I'd been hoping to draw a veil over that. The thing is, I was dressed as a woman at the time, and they
surely you had heard of the travels of Baron von Frimuth to Venice, and I insist Venice, not some Italian dampy swampy place, and you had adopted the custom he brought from this very foreign planet.
Yes, it's as I say, Venus is a personal friend of mine, and she had told me something of this ilk. But she had been telling me of the Baron's misfortunes, but at the same time I was sensing through my sense of smell and my hearing for the sound of the diaphanous silks that she was wearing as they wafted in the Aeolian breezes of Mount Olympus. And I thought, I have to try that. It sounds so delectable against one's skin, I have to give it a try. So I asked her for the address of her dressmaker and proceeded to acquire a full outfit. I quite envy you, ladies, I have to say. The feeling of the undergarments, it's very... It's exciting. But enough of this kind of thing. It's one fears that people not of this circle, not of our esteemed noble lineage, may hear of these things and think less of the nobility as a result. Yes, ended up in Mongolia, sadly arrested, 20 years in a prison on top of a mountain, where I learnt the art of kung fu. But that's an entirely different story.
Your next thing then was this game we played tonight, The Extraordinary Adventures of Baron Munchausen.
That was the next role-playing game I had published. I'd been working on this game, Bugtown, for Eric Wujek's Phage Press. And then it became clear that Eric was just going to keep it in essentially in limbo, in development hell. Because we'd been working on it for about 3 years, and we hadn't really started on the manuscript itself. And he wasn't paying me. He would have paid me once the book came out, but it wasn't ever going to come out. At which point Wizards of the Coast, very rich company, suddenly looking to expand its role-playing line, came to me and said, "We hear you have this game Bugtown. We'd like to publish it." We were in the middle of negotiating the contract. Actually, we were stalled on T-shirt royalties, believe it or not. The trouble with Bugtown, it was based on a line of comics.
Wait, T-shirt royalties? We got some fun with Modifius, and I think it was the foundation of Modifius' budget as well.
Yes, it was. That's what Chris Birch started doing T-shirts before he did Modifius.
Check episode. I don't remember because I'm pissed also. just check the previous episode. There's one called Chris Meet Chris from Modifius, and he tells about his T-shirts. So T-shirts for... It's not
Joystick Junkies.
Yeah, don't Kickstarter. That's nothing. Start with T-shirts. Okay, sorry, I interrupted you.
So anyway, so Bugtown was based on a line of comics called Those Annoying Post Brothers. Quite obscure now. So I had to. It wasn't just me negotiating the deal with Wizards. It was the guy who owned the license for the comics, and he decided he didn't like the percentage being offered for T-shirt royalties. And while we were still quibbling over that, Wizards shut down their entire role-playing line. They'd got a bunch of stuff. They got a bunch of legacy stuff from when they, because they started out as a role-playing company doing, I think they had Talis Lantern. They were doing supplements for stuff. So they had legacy stuff and they bought up a couple of small publishers along the way. But it was clear that a company of that size needed big role-playing games rather than kind of mid-level ones. So before we were in a position to get any kind of kill fee on the deal, they cancelled the role-playing line, and that was that. So I was left with an almost complete role-playing game that I'd put years of work into. I knew the Warhammer license was up for grabs, and Andrew Rilston and myself had started this little kind of quasi-academic journal about game design called Interactive Fantasy, which seemed to be going pretty well. We'd had 2,000 orders for the second issue. So I went, let's start a role-playing company, which I did, and that was Hogshead. Things did not go quite according to plan.
Just cross-referencing other interviews, I heard something about Fantasy Flight Games buying over less Unicorn Games, thinking they would have the rights of, well, several games, including Star Trek. Do you know anything about that?
Oh, I remember hearing stuff at the time. I don't know anything for definite. It's quite possible. I mean, this would have been about 2000, I think, the year 2000. I mean, it's fairly standard when you sign a license with, you know, any major brand. And it was the same clause was in our Warhammer contract, that if the company changes hands or ownership or even directorship, then the license will have to be renegotiated or will lapse. So, you know, I don't know if they bought the company specifically for the license. I mean, they may well have done.
I'm just curious because I remember last Unicorn Games, they had Dune also, which was in the works.
Well, Dune came out. It's one of the great collectible role-playing games.
It did come out?
It's beautiful. Have you not seen it?
No.
It's this gorgeous hardback, and they only ever sold it at Gen Con. I think it was Gen Con 2000. It sells for hundreds of dollars now.
One of the most desirable role-playing games ever, definitely.
Wow. I thought it never came out.
No, it's out there. It's not just collectible because it's collectible, like ST1 Up the Garden Path, which is awful. It's genuinely a brilliant piece of RPG design, and the layout is way ahead of its time. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous book. I remember it was a weird time, that, because Wizards just sold out to Hasbro, and Gen Con, we didn't know if Gen Con was going to continue, and then Peter Atkinson bought Gen Con back from Hasbro. The start of the rise of Fantasy Flight, Last Unicorn, who looked like they were going to be one of the great all-conquering role-playing games, faltered and then just kind of got snapped up and disappeared. It was a time of big change.
You were mentioning Gen Con, big convention. One of the favorites of the rollist is Dragon Meat, and where I met you. What's your relationship with Dragon Meat?
I started Dragon Meat. I and a bunch of others. That's kind of aggrandizing.
Gary, you agree?
I agree. He did. Yep.
It was round about the year 2000. Well, late 90s. The British role playing industry was in one office in Clapham. It was Hogshead Publishing, Nightfall Games, who were doing Slay Industries. We were publishing Slay Industries, but they were developing it for us. Pro Fantasy Software, who did Campaign Cartographer, which you may think of as a tiny little background project that actually makes a decent amount of money, and Pelgrane Press, which had just spun off from Pro Fantasy, which at the time had just launched the Dying Earth RPG. And there were other British role-playing companies. Mongoose had just kind of made its first steps in the industry, but we were the ones that had been around for a while. And we sat around and went, you know, what London really needs is a role-playing convention. And we kind of looked at each other, and then I was aware that people were looking at me, and it was kind of, all right, I suppose. So we did the first one, just kind of more or less as an experiment, and we did not spend a lot of money on it. We did it in Conway Hall, Red Lion Square in Holborn, which is not a great venue for this kind of thing. And I think we got about 500 people, 500 or 600 people, which is pretty respectable.
One of the weird thing about London, because property value is so high, etc., actually making a conference hall is something you don't make a lot of money out. Even in my work, when we are suggesting to have conference halls in places in London, we are told, no, not making enough money. So on one hand, you got London, who would be desperate to build a big convention hall, and you could have a crazy Comic-Con. I mean, they got the XL, but you could have something even bigger for big conventions. It's not happening because it's too expensive. So the convention center are somewhat small, and they were even smaller before the XL came out.
Conway Hall is does anyone know it around the table? It's owned by, and I think they own the freehold, because I don't see how they survive otherwise. I think it's the Freethinkers. It's essentially an atheist group that was set up. It's Victorian originally. It has this large hall that can seat about 300 or 400 people.
What neighborhood is that?
Holborn.
Holborn?
Holborn, yes. It's central London. We got it for Dragon Meat, just for a Saturday. I think we paid just over £1,000 for the whole venue. Admittedly, that's in the year 2000. But still, Central London. I remember we went to Westminster Central Hall for a quote, and they were $5,500. It's this wonderful, slightly musty, slightly eccentric venue, and they won't do. I don't think they'll let you do religious events there. My two main memories of it, I've been to a lot of events there because a lot of slightly low-budget, quirky things have conventions there. There's a big sign above the stage that just says, "To thine own self be true." And then as you're going on stage, there's a sign that says, "Keep wire in correct groove." Both of which, just excellent advice for life, I think, really. Yeah, so that was that. And it was clear that already there was enough of an audience in London for a role-playing event that we should move to a larger venue. So we went to Kensington Town Hall, which is where Salute had been. Salute had recently moved off. I can't remember where Salute had gone. But we were there for, I ran it, I think, for the next 2 or 3 years and then passed it on to other people. I kind of burnt out about 2003. The thing about Hogshead was, you know, for many years, it was the largest role-playing games company in the UK. And it had full-time salaried staff, but I was never one of them. I was always working another job at the same time because I get bored really easily. And if I spend all my time doing one thing, I get bored. So I was managing editor of Bizarre magazine from its launch up to about issue 20. Then I was briefly a TV presenter. Then I did a dot-com.
A TV presenter?
I was a TV presenter in the early days of Sky Digital, before anyone had a digital TV. So nobody... they had
seen you.
Nobody. If our viewing figures got into five figures, that was a major success. But they had to have digital programs before anyone would buy a digital TV. Why would you buy a digital TV if there was nothing to watch with it? So it was a channel called .TV in square brackets, which is impossible to Google these days. Not least because the .TV domain now actually exists as a TLD. It's the islands of Tuvalu, I believe. But yeah, I co-presented a show called Download and Download Extra, which was about the internet in the year 2000. And it was great. It was huge fun. It wasn't terribly well paid. But it was, you know, it scratched that itch. Okay, I've done TV. Don't need to do TV anymore. Don't need to think about that as kind of an aspiration. As I say, did a dot-com, did another magazine, did movie publicity, which was a hoot. And again, scratched that itch, done the movie business, sort of. Got to do did two Star Wars documentaries voiced by Anthony Daniels. So I got to write dialogue for Anthony Daniels. So again, box ticked, don't need to do that. Bored of film publicity now. Went off, helped a couple of friends, did a startup games company, digital, called Six to Start, which went pretty well, sort of. And I left there and I just thought, this is ridiculous. The games industry is what I keep coming back to. Tabletop is what I really love, and it seems to be what I'm good at. So at that point, I set up my consultancy, Space, with 3As in 2008, I think, and haven't looked back.
One of your other professional activities is teaching to wannabe game designers or to be a game designer.
Yeah, I'm a part-time lecturer at London South Bank University on their game design and development degree. And I specifically teach the game narrative and interactive storytelling module and also tabletop game design, which is an important part of learning to be any kind of game designer. But even for video game design, if you can prototype a game on the tabletop with cards and bits of stuff, you will save yourself so much time working out if it's fun, where the fun is, where the problems are, what the shape of the game is and what its structure is. It's an important discipline. And the students usually produce some really interesting. We've literally this week finished that module for this year. But I also teach at Central Film School, teaching screenwriters how to write for interactive, which is interesting because these are guys who already know how to structure a story and they know about characters and they know about world building, all the rest of it, but they don't know the games. So it's approaching two different courses, approaching the same point from completely different directions. It's really interesting. And the questions they ask and the stuff they come up with is really, it keeps my ideas churning.
This episode included Solta of Frango, or theme song by Bandido Roll, which you can download on the Free Music Archive. The tavern ambience was provided by Sword Coast Soundscapes, which is a YouTube channel where you will find a number of different moods for your D&D games. Those I picked were from a complete playlist with tavern soundscapes. And it turns out that Swarko Soundscape will be part of the 25 shows of the Podcast Zone on December 2nd at Dragon Meet. For the complete list of the show joining, check the description of this episode. I inserted a little visual. And check out if your favorite shows is there, and maybe give a try to all these shows ahead of Dragon Meet. And in Dragon Meet, you will have an opportunity to meet the producers of those shows. I will be myself, of course, representing the RPG Academy network. Thanks again to James Wallis for being a fantastic guest. There will be a second part with more amazing stories, both from the life of the Baron of Munchausen and from James Wallis, in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, definitely check at Fantasy Flight Games The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. And I also recommend another recent project of James Wallis with Grant Owitt and Paul Dean, which is the brand new version of Paranoia, published by Mongoose RPG. I got my own copy here, and it's super cool. I mean, everything, it's spot on if you enjoyed the humor of the original Paranoia game. Yeah, you even have forms to fill out as part of the little box with everything. But James himself will tell you more about this game in the part 2 of our Baron of Munchausen episode. See you in a couple of weeks, and in the meantime, have good games! Holy, holy, holy. Solta o frango e vem com a gente. Nós é tipo bem Jesus, todo mundo a gente ama. Ainda mais se for gatinha, rola até levar pra cama. A gente topa tudo, sapatão e bigoduto. Na hora do piriri, cai em mim outra travesti. Vai, batuque! Holy, holy, holy. Solta o frango e vem com a gente. Holy, holy, holy. Solta o frango e vem com a gente.
Jokes, definitely.
And now I'm going to put the strudel in the oven.
Strudel is just, it's one of those funny words, isn't it?
We should have. I love strudel.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
One of my favorite things. Yeah.
I wish I drank wine before I started.
I wish I knew I would have not driven.